All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This evening is March 22nd. This is the board meeting of the agenda of the Board of Education, West Covina Unified School District, March 22nd, 6 o'clock. I'll call the meeting to order. Is there anybody here that wishes to discuss anything on any closed session items we may be discussing this evening? Seeing none, this evening we are going to discuss in closed session the expulsion of four students, public employee discipline, dismissal, release, and transfer and appointment, and conference with our labor negotiators, with CSEA and CTA. And we will then close and go into closed session at 6:02. Welcome to the meeting, West Covina Unified School District Board of Education, March 22nd, 2011. We've returned from closed session, and we will go into our regular session this evening, 7:02. We'll start this evening's meeting with an invocation given, is there anybody in the audience who would like to give an invocation? No, then Mike Spence will lead us in an invocation, followed by a flag salute by Aline Miranda Jimenez. Will you please rise?
Father in heaven, we're grateful that we can gather here as a West Covina Unified School District Board of Trustees. We're grateful for the opportunity to serve, and we're grateful for this district, for the parents who send their children and trust us. We're grateful for the staff who work so diligently on their behalf. And Father, we'd ask a blessing on them and on this meeting. And this we pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Please join me in the flag salute. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please. Here.
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 Here. This evening in closed session, we have the following action item taken. It was moved by Cami Polis, seconded by Jessica Shoemaker, and approved to expel the following students from the schools in the district. Student number 183953 for dangerous object and disruption. 173026 for possession of sales of a controlled substance. Student number 199428, theft and disruption. Student number to be determined for theft and disruption. These pupils were expelled and will not be eligible to apply for readmission until the date set in their rehabilitation plans. And that motion was passed without objection, 5-0. Anybody have anything that they need to report this evening? Mike? No? Jessica? Eileen?
Yeah, I wanted to say that the teachers and the principals and the staffs have done an amazing job at the open houses. It's been a pleasure to go visit the campuses. I also want to give my congratulations to the GATE showcase for the elementary school level. The students did just incredible work. Their presentations were succinct, on task. They were really good. It was a different format this year, so I was really pleased with that this year. So, again, congratulations to everyone.
All right. Mr. Spence.
I was at the GATE thing as well, and it was very good. It went really well. I was just surprised that there was no award ceremony to recognize the achievement and hard work of those that excelled beyond others. I was kind of disappointed that it was that we weren't doing that. Anyway.
Go ahead. Ms. Matilla.
So this past Friday was the WASC in service meeting, and what they had was teachers and students and other staff and parents worked together, and they looked at the students' work and they identified what was essential for students to learn, where the gaps were, like where they could better them, and how to bridge the gaps for future lessons. And testing season is coming up. The KC makeup for 10th graders. The STAR testing is after spring break. AP exams are the first 2 weeks of May. And also for the AP testing, we just got done with finishing the rest of the deposits. And we also got this award from the College Board, fewer than 400 school districts in the nation. It's because we increased the number of students participating in AP courses while improving our percentage of people passing a 3 or higher, which is usually what we need to get college credit. And in 2009, it was 57%, and then in 2010, it was 66%. And then this year, we had over 1,000 kids register for AP testing, and so hopefully the percentage goes even higher. And then, for activities, this past Saturday, our Women's Chamber Choir and Musco Bears, they went to the Heritage Music Festival in SD, and they won second. Our Gemline took first at Little Rock High School, and Color Guard took first at Glendora, and that was their third first so far. And then our All-Maryland Dance Drill, Large Military second, Medium Military first, Small Military second, Small Palm fourth, Large All-Male second, Small All-Male third, Co-Ed Hip Hop fourth, Co-Ed Dance second, and then their USA Nationals are this weekend. Our class officer elections are Thursday for next year. and then our journalism, they went to their first write-off competition. It was in LA at the LA County Journalism Education Association. And Janine Calderon took 10th, Shereen Dudar took 6th in editorial writing. Lizette Gomez took 4th in critics review. And then this Friday is the NHS Talent Show, and our dodgeball intramural is next week.
Very good. Thank you very much. Next item is the items from the floor and public comment. I do have two requests to speak this evening, so we'll start with Maria Chavira.
Hi, good evening. I'm here tonight to address Mrs. Castillo, our superintendent, regarding the comment you made at the March 8th meeting. I, along with other parents in the audience, were appalled by the way you commented and the manner in which you commented on how our children have been eating or the way that they've been eating or getting their meals for the past 5 years. The tone and the manner of your reply clearly told us that the well-being of our children is not a priority for you. With your response, you communicated to us that you feel no sense of urgency in making sure that our children are out of the elements anytime soon. It will rain once again tomorrow. I ask you to meet me at Edison tomorrow at 11:40. That's the time my son gets his lunch. I want you to walk the path with me and my son while he picks up his lunch and looks for a dry place to eat. In the meantime, up until now, our teachers have graciously opened their doors for our children whenever it is possible for them. Not having a designated sheltered eating area is not acceptable. I'm requesting that you call me tomorrow prior, or let me know tomorrow or after the meeting, and let me know when the tables will be arriving. You said at the last meeting it would be 4 to 6 weeks. Prior to that, you knew 2 weeks prior to that that we were requesting it, and even before that, that we had this need. So I don't understand what the holdup is. The disconnect and lack of concern with the well-being of our children is shocking. I ask you to begin to make amends to our children by apologizing to them and to us. Thank you.
Mr. Enriquez, I believe. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen of the school board, my name is Chris Enriquez. This is my son. I also have a daughter who attends San Jose Edison Academy. I also have two nephews and three nieces who currently attend the school, as well as two other nephews and one niece who have graduated from there. I would like to remind you that I've spoken before on two other occasions, and would like to remind you that I am a product of the West Covina Unified School District, having attended Monta Vista Elementary, Willowood Junior High, Edgewood, and West Covina High Schools. On the previous times I've spoken to you, I've spoken from the heart. I just let it roll all out. But after listening online to the recordings of the board meeting, the last board meeting, I felt it was best served to write down what I wanted to say. I half expected to walk into this room and see scuff marks on the carpet. I say this because there seems to be a lot of foot dragging in this matter. We're talking about facilities that are sitting there waiting to be used while the school board reviews this and reviews that. Now, I understand things have to be done in a certain manner. I totally understand it, but this is getting ridiculous. Now, I hesitate to say Edison because I feel the tension emanating from some of the school board members, especially when the word Edison is brought up. San Jose Edison has been jumping through hoops to appease many of the board members. Now, this analogy of jumping through hoops is perfect since this is beginning to look like a lot like a circus, with the students and faculty looking like that of the trained dogs jumping through the hoops as the members of the school board snap their whips. It's looking like a game of setup and sabotage. How long do you intend to dangle the carrot of these facilities in front of the Edison students? Now, some board members don't even refer to it as San Jose Edison and would much rather say the Willowood site. I know it as San Jose Edison, even though I went to Willowood. The work is complete, and according to the board, the multipurpose room or building F is up to code. It is sitting there. It is ready, and the children wait. Would we be even having these discussions of occupancy if these buildings were not used for Edison or for rather one other of the other schools in the district? This question needed to be asked. It still sits, it's still ready, and it still waits. According to this board, the Holocrant School was made ready in approximately 90 days for it to be ready. Yet the San Jose Edison kids still have to stand and eat lunch. Yes, they're still waiting and still standing. The awning area has been ready for months, and the Junior Academy, my son, is still waiting to get in there. One board member several weeks ago made it a point to say that they had visited the school and saw no children there, as if to say, well, it's there, they're not using it, and they're still waiting. I had made this suggestion the last time I spoke, about not the last meeting, but the prior meeting, and I'll make it again. The next time you go to eat lunch, or better yet, the next time children in your family want to eat, make them stand up. Make them sit on the floor. When it rains, put their food outside and make them go get it. Maybe you will understand. 4 to 6 weeks for tables and chairs? Are you kidding me? Now they have to wait for that to get into the room? Now you're concerned whether they eat on the ground? Really? 4 to 6 weeks? You know, I listened to the recordings and I heard it clearly. Well, they've been there for 5 years, as if to suggest, well, they've waited this long, they can wait a little bit longer. Not so much. See, it rained Monday, and my son and his friends had to run clear across campus in the rain and run back to eat their class in their classroom. He had a hot dog. It was hot, and it made him feel better. Why? Because the multipurpose room is ready, sitting, waiting to be used, and I'm here wondering if the school board actually really gives a damn about the kids of San Jose Edison. After 2 months of this, I don't think so. But I ask you and I implore you, make me a liar, so they don't have to sit and wait. Tomorrow it's going to rain. And it's very funny because, you know, I heard the last speaker talk about her son, and everything she said is exactly what I wrote in here. So you understand that the parents, I guess, are feeling the same way. But I'll read what I wrote. Tomorrow it's going to rain. Tell me what to say to him about where he eats. Or better yet, why don't you come down and join them for lunch and see what it's like? This board has the last word and can rebut any of the statements declaring how much you care for the students of West Covina Unified School District. Actions speak louder than words, but compassion can be heard throughout the world. Show the students of San Jose Edison that this school board has compassion. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shoemaker.
Just a couple quick items. One of them is Hollencrest. I keep hearing how it was readied in 90 days. I remember attending board meetings where different board members were talking about how the school was going to take much, much longer to prepare than anybody had thought because the school was in such utter disarray. Namely, ceilings had collapsed in it because it hadn't been taken care of for years, and that it had been used as the parts, basically, depot for the rest of the school district. So I'm not sure where that 90 days comes from, because I know of at least a year that things like that were going on. Now, maybe once all the repairs and everything had been made, it was 90 days from that point, but it sure wasn't 90 days from the day the board said, let's reopen it. And it was never 90 days. Matter of fact, because Jessica ended up going to a different school, or Julie, I forget which one it was, because it wasn't ready yet, because it took so much longer. Mr. Spence, you can sit there and shake your head and make all the little remarks that you want under your breath, but you know it's true, and that's all there is to it. You know, so you can keep on all you want showing the disrespect that you have for people. Regarding the other item about the room being open, you know, I'm sorry, there's certain rules that you guys have to go by that's unfortunate. I remember the high school bought a mobile from the wrong company, and it was left sitting there for months because it had to get the approvals from the correct state agencies when mobiles were brought into the high school. So, yes, it is a process that is absolutely ridiculous. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. But to sit here and blame the superintendent because benches aren't there, in 2008, you said it's been going on for 5 years.
Yeah.
2008, nobody said a word about it.
Address your comments.
Nobody said a word about it.
Address your comments this
that year, Edison took in $1.4 million, and they didn't care enough to buy some benches and then come into negotiations and say, school board, pay for it. I know I would have. When I work, when I have problems with one of my vendors, I go and buy something, fix it, get it taken care of, and then I force them to pay for it. So if Edison had cared, they would have bought the things and made sure it was part of the contract or the negotiations to get their money back. So don't blame people sitting here. And when you say the school board's delaying, you have three votes in your pocket, you know, that they never vote no against Edison on anything. Three of them. So you're looking at the wrong thing. Go start really looking at what Edison's done to you. You know, maybe they should have been buying benches for the kids to eat in instead of buying diamond necklaces for the principal. So please kind of get your facts right for once. And, Mr. Spence, I appreciate your respect.
Is there anybody else who would like to address the board at this time? Please state your name, please.
My name is Dr. Denise Patton. I'm the principal of San Jose Edison Academy, and I'm here to speak this evening on the topic of inaccurate information being distributed to parents during open house. Issues relating to the education of children in the district are significant and critical to the future of this community, and most certainly to the future of each and every student attending the district schools. With this in mind, the inaccurate and fabricated information being distributed and communicated relating to the operation of San Jose Edison School is not only an attempt to misrepresent facts, but it is also a supreme disservice to the students and parents of this district who seek quality educational opinion.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to address the board at this time? All right. With that, we will move to the next item, which is the business session. and organization, and in deference to our attorneys who are here this evening, I've been asked to move item number 18 regarding the San Jose Edison Academy Facilities Use Agreement forward on the agenda, and we will hear it after item number 5. Are there any other changes or items to discuss?
I'm sorry, where are we moving it?
After item number 5.
I would like to remove items 13 and 14. And then I had a question. This draft health outline, does that replace the health outline we got in the packet?
Yes, we'll get to that when we get to that.
Well, I just want to make sure because we're approving the agenda.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. I don't know if that answers something.
Anybody else have any changes?
I'm sorry, what numbers did he ask to take off?
13 and 14. Is there a motion, please?
I'll move as
amended. It's moved by Jessica Shoemaker. Okay. Seconded by Cami Polis to approve the agenda as amended in moving item number 18 to be heard after item number 5 and to take off a consent items number 13 and 14. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the motion is so ordered. With that, since the first 5 items are on consent, we will hear item number 18. And did you want to comment first? Okay, go ahead.
I would like to call on Mr. Trevin Sims, legal counsel for the school district, to give us an update regarding number 18 and answer any of the board's questions.
Good evening again, and thank you for moving me up on the agenda. I'm here to give you an update on the negotiations for the use agreement for the additional facilities for San Jose Edison. And I'll also acknowledge that San Jose Edison's legal counsel, Jerry Simmons, is here today as well. We've been working pretty vigorously at coming to terms on an agreement. And I think I can speak accurately for both counsel that we think we've come pretty close to the terms of an agreement, but there are some fairly significant remaining business points, as I'll call them, that I think we as counsel for the district need some clarification on the direction. One of those points is whether or not the district desires to, well, let me step back a minute. We've been negotiating this agreement on the understanding that this is an agreement to provide use of these facilities simply for the remainder of this school year through June 30th, 2011, and that the direction that the district desires to go is that San Jose Edison will have no further rights necessarily to the use of those additional facilities post the expiration of that term. And the larger, broader context is we're expecting a new petition from San Jose Edison to amend the current charter, which could impact not only the current facilities, but the use of the additional facilities and other aspects of the relationship between the charter school and the district, so that the reason for the one-year exclusive or the end-of-the-year exclusive term of this was to make sure that the district maintained its flexibility as to those facilities at the end of this year once you've seen and had a chance to review and act upon that revised petition. Okay. So with that said, one of the major business points is whether or not the district desires to charge a user fee for those facilities. Under the Charter School Act and bylaw, you're allowed to do so, but not required to do so. In the original draft of the use agreement that my co-counsel drafted and forwarded to Mr. Simmons, we included a provision whereby the district would charge a user fee. And I don't remember the exact fee. It was right around $2 per square foot or so. Yes. Something like that. Yes. And I think that essentially $2 per square foot per year, we're talking about 12,000 square feet. So if you prorate that for 3 months, assuming, for example, they use the full 12,000 square feet for 3 months from April through end of June, I think we're roughly talking about $6,000 or so. In their revised draft back of the agreement, San Jose Edison's council deleted that language and indicated that they did not intend to pay a use fee. Again, like I said, it's the district, we believe, has the right to charge it, is not obligated to. Ordinarily, the issue becomes what's the rate that's charged. It becomes sometimes a significant dispute and point of negotiation. Another significant business point was the cost of any necessary improvements or recommended improvements by the district's architect to get the facilities ready for occupancy. I know there was a meeting between some district staff and consultants and representatives of the charter school at the end of last week to go over again and try and clear up any differences or misunderstandings about the intended uses, and that the architect participated in that meeting. And based upon that meeting, prepared a summary for the district that I believe was provided to each of you, outlining the improvements or additions that they suggested for safety and ADA and fire life issues. I tried to do a rough calculation of the total amount of the estimated costs, and I think for Building E it was roughly about $62,000 or $63,000. Building F, it seemed to be very minimal. Most of the things were, because they weren't going to use the kitchen, was getting the cafeteria area ready, which included the ordering of tables and things like that, which I believe has already been done. So that the significant cost piece of this appears, based upon the architect's report, to be the improvements that would be necessary for Building E. So then the question, the business question is whether the district would pay those costs, whether the district would expect San Jose Edison to pay those costs. Without getting in too detail in this setting of the issues here, because I think we've outlined these previously to you in correspondence, under the current management agreement, it basically provides that San Jose Edison will be responsible for improvements or additions or things that relate or derive from their unique educational design, things that are necessary or to get the facilities up to ADA or general district standards, the district would generally fund. There's an argument here that this particular agreement that you're entering into doesn't even necessarily fall under the current management agreement, and so that the parties could separately sort of negotiate, all right, who's going to pay for what. I suspect that my colleague, Mr. Simmons, would disagree with that to some extent. But I think the foundational question is the direction the district wants to go with respect to the cost associated with Building E as recommended by the architect. Another issue is the timing of occupancy of the facilities. We could certainly negotiate language, and I think this is the language that I've most recently proposed, that basically says the facilities will be appropriate for the intended use and meet district and all legal requirements for occupancy and use. And then the question becomes when they reach that level and whether or not San Jose Edison is allowed to occupy and use the buildings in whole or in part prior to the improvements that have been recommended being done. So, for example, I think there's minimal cost and other items that need to be done for Building F before occupancy and use. So I think there would be a way to structure this so that we could pretty quickly allow, if we reach the terms of an agreement, use and occupancy of Building F, even if they don't immediately have access to Building E because the work being recommended is so much more extensive. But the fundamental question is, does the district want it all to allow occupancy before these improvements, the recommended improvements, have been done? And then a final issue, or business point, is the cost of certain what I'm calling ancillary services that are provided to San Jose Edison that with the additional facilities may increase. And there are two specific examples that I've been made aware of, and that's custodial services. Under the management agreement, it says that San Jose Edison essentially is responsible for janitorial and custodial services. But apparently the way the parties have effectuated that operationally is that the district provides those services through its classified employees, and Edison Learning pays that cost. The question is whether or not to service this additional 12,000 square feet or some portion thereof, the district is going to incur additional cost, and whether or not we are going to charge Edison for those additional costs consistent with the current practice with the current facilities. Similarly, you provide nutrition services, and those are billed back to Edison Learning. So the question is, if the district has to incur additional costs to provide those nutrition services as a result of the use of the additional facilities, is the district going to charge Eli for those costs under the current operational practice? So my goal is to let the board know kind of where we are, see where the district wants to go with respect to those issues, and then I suspect Mr. Simmons and I will talk pretty quickly, probably after this meeting, about where we're going to go from there. Are there any particular questions?
At a previous meeting, and you've already stated this, that Ed, is it Styler?
Sklar.
Raised the fact that the charter school is responsible for the modifications to the facilities that are unique to the charter's program. Are the modifications that are being recommended by the architect to consider, are they unique to, that the architect's saying needed to be done, are those unique to their particular program? And I don't know if you could answer that. And I, because you did say that this may not even fall under our current management agreement.
Yeah. Well, I will say this, that at least in the architect's most recent report, the architect talks about them being recommendations to satisfy current ADA guidelines and get the facilities up to the district's current standards. So by that definition, I think an argument could be made that it's not necessarily unique to their program. I don't have the benefit of having been involved in the negotiations at the time that language was inserted into the agreement to know what exactly the parties intended. But I think one other way to ask the question is, if this were a non-charter school within the district and the architect was recommending these particular improvements and ADA guideline and safety issues to get them up to district standards, you know, is that something that the district would feel it would ordinarily pay for?
Okay. Let me, I just want to get down. Okay. According to the charter's renewal on page 26, it describes the art and music and physical education programs being provided to the students on a weekly basis. I'm wondering how many periods will the classrooms being requested be utilized? I went through all of my notes, and this is what I have. The estimated number of students participating in the use of buildings are as follows. The band room would have 175 students during the school, and that's all of these are going to just be for the junior academy, and then 70 after school, and there will be approximately 35 to 40 students at any given time in that classroom. And then I have it listed out for all of the different programs that they've talked about. In the most recent one, they don't talk about art, and that's so I'm not sure if they don't plan on using a room for art anymore. But my biggest question is, are these daily uses, or is this once a week uses? Because when I went to Willowwood, when it was a Willowwood site, chorus and band shared the same room.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
And so then, if that could be, then we may be able to, if they could only utilize one room for all of their students like we did when we went to Willowwood, that could leave one more room that we could lease out and recoup some of the money that we're going to put in to fix it up.
Okay.
But there's nothing that I could read that says, because the agreement we have with them is that they were going to do it weekly, not daily. At our last board meeting, fire life safety issues were raised by the architect and were outlined for use in the site update dated March 18th, 2011. In the site assessment, costs were associated with a number of issues. To name just a few, this is for Building E. They need a new bell system, installation of phones and possible phone lines, a PA system, and connection to the data drops. Is the charter school still unwilling to pick up any of the costs for these? And I heard you say that they are not willing to pay for any of this at this time?
Yeah. The last position that I was informed of, that they were not going to pay for any of the improvements. And I think, again, that goes in part to this issue of the unique design. Again, depending on what the parties intended when they negotiated that, I mean, you could argue that, well, any use that they want to make of that building or those buildings different than what sort of they were originally designed for is a cost that is associated with their particular use. So, for example, if the district were going to use these buildings simply for their original purposes, would they incur these costs? I don't know the answer to that. That's a question for the architect. But if the district would not incur all of these additional costs, then maybe you can parcel out some that, all right, these are things that regardless of the use, we would have to incur. But because of their particular use that's different than the original use, we're incurring this cost. Maybe that's a cost that they should pay for. We haven't had, in my mind, a discussion at that level in terms of apportioning costs, because at this point it's been, all right, either you pay or we pay.
When there's a change to the contract, let's say they're going to be offering these daily instead of weekly, how do they have to negotiate that, or is that just something that they can decide to do, and then it would be, they would need more classes if they were going to provide band every day, and then they were going to provide chorus every day, if they were going to provide, there was physical fitness and there might have been, oh, and art every day. That would change what they contracted to do, but as a result, they may need more space. So how does that work?
It is a good question, and I think your question points out one of the larger issues we're facing, not only with the negotiation of this use agreement, but I think what San Jose Edison and their representatives are facing with the petition, which is, you know, one thing affects another thing affects another thing, and sometimes it takes some time and some thought to really play it out to make sure you've covered all your bases. So with that, I'll say, under the current management agreement, San Jose Edison has a lot of autonomy in terms of how they operate this school. But one area in which they don't have autonomy, in which the board has specifically reserved the right to approve, is with changes to the educational program. So one question could be with respect to the number of days that a class is provided or what that class composition or substance is, that may be an issue that even under the current management agreement, they need to submit to the board for approval. Part of that may be, again, how you guys have operated with respect to those issues historically under the management agreement. Or it may be a new novel issue that the parties need to talk about.
Since this is a district property, we want to ensure that the facilities are safe for students and the buildings are used appropriately. Would it be less expensive to have our staff do the work that needs to be done?
It may be. Under the public contract code, it does permit the district to use its own forces to perform certain work, but I believe that it's limited in terms of the number of hours of your staff that can be used. And it may depend on really the scope of work and just the competency of your staff to do the work. But it is an option.
So it depends.
Yes.
Is the answer. Mm-hmm. If our staff cannot do the work for whatever reason, should the district or the charter find an independent contractor to do the work? And the question is, who should find the contractor? Should we allow them to go out and do that, or should we do that if we need an outside contractor?
Well, I think the preliminary issue would be, given the estimated cost of the work, whether it would not need to be publicly bid. And certainly if the district is expending district funds to do the work, and it's above the public contract limit of $15,000, you would be required to publicly bid it unless it fell within an exception or you could perform it with your own forces. Assuming you can't perform it with your own forces and there's no exception, you'd publicly bid it and award to the lowest responsible and responsive bidder. So it would not be a selection of a particular contractor. It would be you advertise for bids just like you would any other construction project, and you award it to the lowest responsible bidder.
Are the charters exempt from the bidding out process?
Well, I don't think there is consensus on that. I think you will get a different opinion from most attorneys that represent school districts and different than attorneys who represent charters. Without getting into all the legal issues, our position has been, particularly where district money is being expended on district facilities, that the work comply with the public contract code. And oftentimes, we will attempt to work into the agreement with the charter school that they will abide by these particular provisions as well. But I'm pretty sure that Mr. Simmons would have a different view of that.
If the charter is allowed to do the work and then bill the district, how much control does the district have over costs?
Well, it depends on how we structure the agreement. The agreement could be structured in a way that the district could exert a lot of control. But when you have a publicly bid contract, the control you have for cost through change orders and other things is somewhat limited, as you probably have experienced in other construction projects. So you can certainly say the district wants to have a representative, like your facilities director or whatever, involved in any decision on a change order or reviewing the contractor's invoices for services, and that it required district approval. Those are certainly terms that we could state that we want to require as part of the contract.
There's additional costs related to the nutritional services described in our update that we just received. I'm wondering who will pick up these costs. Who will pay for the additional custodian costs if additional space? Are they willing to pay for any of the additional nutritional costs? And that would be, it talked about the carts, they needed new carts to come over, that type of thing, to bring the lunches over in our latest update.
As I stand here now, Ellison Learning has not agreed to fund any of those costs. Although I've had a conversation with Mr. Simmons about the district's position on it, and I think where we left it was that I think they're open to operating under the current agreement, which is the district will bill for those nutritional services. If there are additional costs, as long as there's a sufficient explanation as to why there's that additional cost. So I will say at this point there is no agreement, but I wouldn't say that the parties are at impasse.
But they have, at least it looks like they may pay for the additional cost incurred to have the additional person with the carts to distribute the food at the Junior Academy.
Yes, I would say we're not at impasse there. In my conversation with Mr. Simmons, he was willing to explore it. It was not, under no circumstances will we pay those costs.
Okay. Who will pay for the additional custodian costs if additional space is being utilized by the charter?
I think my conversation with Mr. Simmons was exactly the same as with the nutrition services.
You'll explore it?
Yes. We are not at impasse. I think the position was, all right, our current operating procedure is you charge us for those services. If you convincingly demonstrate that to service the additional 12,000 square feet or whatever portion of that we use, that you are going to incur these costs, then we're open to paying those costs under our current arrangement. He didn't guarantee it, but what I took from the conversation was, let's have that specific conversation, convince me, and then I will talk to my client about it.
Will the charter continue to pay for the utilities, the additional utilities for the two rooms if they use those rooms?
My position is, if they pay for it under the current agreement, I don't see any basis for changing that. But I haven't had a specific conversation with Mr. Simmons on that point. I don't know if Mr. Sklar has.
Okay. I know this isn't a question you can answer, but the parents are concerned about where their children will eat, and I know we've tried to take care of that. I'm wondering where they ate in the rain prior to the fire. I know that whole area was closed off prior to the fire. After the fire. But before the fire, I saw parents taking their children through that sheltered area the whole time under the awning, not the buildings, but the awning. Were they eating under the awning then? And did they have tables under the awning to eat at? And if so, where are the tables now that they were utilizing? Or have they been standing and eating for 5 years and it wasn't an issue? Or were there tables at one time and where are they? And I guess somebody can answer that later.
Yeah, I don't know.
So if they've been standing and eating, it's been since the inception of the school, and that there was rain every year. Oh, and it's been very hot sometimes, so I'm not sure what was happening to those students if there were no tables. And it wasn't an issue. I didn't hear a parent come to us and complain, so were they able to eat in the multi-purpose room at the elementary school? I don't have those answers, and I would like to know how that worked out in the past if we didn't hear anybody ask what was happening. And hopefully tomorrow, if their table's hidden somewhere, wherever they ate before in the past, if those tables could be made available to them under the awning if they were there before,
once
that would be great for tomorrow.
Right. Once we finish questioning Mr. Sims, I'm going to give Edison an opportunity to rebut, and at that time maybe we can get those answers.
Rebut?
Or whatever you call it.
I hope that
or
that makes it sound very confrontational, and what we're trying to do
right.
is what's best
okay.
for the students.
Are you finished?
Yes.
Okay. Eileen?
You answered some of my questions. The DSA dollar limit, I think I heard you say $15,000?
No, that is the public contract called
okay.
bidding limit.
What is the DSA dollar limit?
The DSA dollar limit that the architect is referring to. Don't quote me, but I think it's in the $60,000 range or something. I'd have to verify that.
Okay. So if it's under $60,000, then there doesn't need to necessarily be submitted a plan for review. Is that
yeah,
what I'm understanding?
That's what the architect's report indicates.
Okay. And then the question Ms. Pellis asked, which is what I had, can our district maintenance do this work? I'm specifically looking at Building F, being that the scope is so limited, there's not a whole lot, there's not even a dollar amount attached to this. So our district can do the work required for Building F?
I believe so.
Okay. And then you mentioned that they could occupy quickly. My question was, how quickly? Building F. I'm looking specifically at Building F. How quickly can Edison occupy Building F?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. That would be a question I think is better directed to Mr. Larkin and or Lori, the architect.
Okay. So the architects would tell us how quickly they can
well,
occupy
it. It's more so if you were to do the work with your own staff, coordinating the work, getting whatever materials and supplies and things that are necessary for that work. And I can't really speculate on how long that would take.
Can I try to answer some of this?
I'll give you a chance to respond, but I'd like to try to go through and I was going to ask all of us to try to direct the questions that are appropriate.
Right.
For Mr. Sims to answer at this point in time, and then we'll get to the other ones and answer, and we're going to discuss the architect's thing at another point in time.
I simply wanted to make a point that the answers to those questions are in writing. You all got them. Okay, so
right.
there's Building F.
Right.
It talks about the work. It talks about the schedule. I'm just making a clarifying point so that everyone knows that you have the answers to those questions.
Right. Well, we have a presentation. I don't know that we have all of the answers.
Right.
What
to
we're
her
doing
questions
right now,
are there.
To right now, and I go to each
no,
of us all that are going to be speaking. No. Let's direct our questions to what the attorney can address and to the issues that he presented this evening, and then we'll go from there. We'll have plenty of opportunity to discuss all of the other issues related that are not legally related. So,
thank you.
Thank
you.
Capacity?
Okay, the other questions I have is for staff, so those were my only ones for the attorney.
My main question, and I don't know if you will be able to answer it publicly, is these buildings were not part of the original approved contract for Edison. And the language that you talk about if it's for a program-specific item, Edison is in charge of it. That was put in because one of the buildings was thought to possibly be part of their E2 program. and the E2 program would have had a building as a learning lab. And so because modifications would have been needed for that building, it was the intent of the contract that if they wanted to use that building, they would be responsible for the cost of that building. I don't know how, now that they want to use it for the intended use of the building, you know, fine, but it's still, I need to know whether or not it is considered part of their original contract. Because if it's part of their original contract and they're entitled to use the facilities, this becomes a completely different conversation than going to the second part of the section, which their contract, which talks about if they get additional facilities, the process that will be followed, their responsibilities and our duties. I see buildings E and F as not part of their facilities. Therefore, any modifications that need to be done to it, program or otherwise, should be Edison's responsibility. I understand they want to use it for its intended use now, but the district, the buildings were sitting empty. When you compare it to other school sites, you know, do we want to bring it up to the safety and standard codes? Yes, if we were using the buildings, we would bring it up to the health and safety codes where we are supposed to. But buildings E and F had nothing on our calendar to be used for that would have necessitated bringing it up to that level. And so I have said that I have no problem with Edison having the first shot at those facilities, bringing a proposal forward as to what they want to do with those buildings. But Edison, if they want the additional part of the campus as part of their facilities, needs to pay the cost to make them usable for their students and also, you know, pay for the facilities as they do for the daycare part of their campus. And so I just see that at this point, we're sort of, at least in for anything I would vote for, are at opposite ends. If Edison wants to use the buildings, they need to pay rent for them. They need to pay the cost of getting the buildings to where they want them to be. The timeline that we have for, I mean, this facilities use agreement is supposed to end June 30th, 2011. I understand that we now finally have Edison Learning agreeing to be the signer on the agreement. But I look at the site assessment from our architect, and it says, if the work determined to be done is under the DSA dollar limit, it will not be required to be submitted for plan review. Great. Therefore, once a bid package is developed, the project can be bid. It should take approximately 2 weeks to prepare a bid package based on the above scope of work. So if we signed tomorrow and decided that the district is responsible, therefore we have to go out to bid, it's going to take at least 2 weeks to get a bid package ready. That doesn't include the time for people to bid on the contract and then the time to do the work. Assuming that even our staff can do it so we don't have to bid, it's going to take time to get all of the equipment in and really assess all of the final needs. And Ms. Miranda Jimenez is correct. Building F doesn't look like there's a lot to do, so it probably will not invoke the DSA dollar limit, obviously, if it's around $60,000. So, but we're negotiating a facilities use contract for buildings E and F. So I don't think you can separate the two out. Looking at building E, the estimated construction cost right now is over the DSA limit, period. And that's assuming that you aren't adding 40% to the $63,000 because our staff can do it all, if they can do it all. And if we get into DSA territory, it'll take 2 to 6 months to even get approval from DSA. So I'm back to asking the question with, why are we doing this? I mean, our attorneys had specifically said, you know, we're about to go into contract negotiations with Edison because they intend to go independent. I don't understand why we're spending all of this time on a facilities use agreement for buildings that the facilities use agreement ends on June 30th. And the buildings at this point, at least according to what we're getting, cannot be ready in time. And so I don't know what direction the board is going to go. I just think it's a ridiculous waste of money at this point.
Do you have any questions for him? Or is that it? Okay. Mr. Spence?
Legally speaking, you know, this board in January approved a substantially complete. We declared the project being substantially complete and within 60 days, you know, that we would file a notice of completion with the DSA and the state. I don't know if we've done that or not. But what does that mean? If we file something in notice of completion, because obviously I'm a little confused because to me notice of completion means it's complete. And then obviously when I look at, you know, what's sent to us over the weekend, you know, clearly the project, at least from what I view the word complete to mean, isn't complete. So what does the notice of completion actually mean from a legal standpoint?
Well, the notice of completion, technically under the law, the notice of completion impacts when material men and other providers of services triggers their statute of limitations to file claims against the project. What it means, I think, importantly for the district here is that we're talking about the project being done in substantial compliance to the plans and specifications submitted to DSA. And as best as I recall, the architect's explanation was that, you know, because of the agreement that the district had with the insurance company that funded the majority or bulk, if not all, of these repairs, it was basically improved back to its original condition. And I should distinguish between F and E because I think the architect has made it clear there were no modifications done to building E. And I think that's why you see in their assessment why the majority of the improvement work that they're suggesting is to building E, because it remains consistent with the specs that were approved back in 1960-something or whatever when it was constructed.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to building F, I think what happened was it was built to its original purpose with some upgrades. And so given those upgrades and the intended uses, what you're seeing is the architect saying there's not as much that needs to be done with that building. So the notice of completion is in relationship to the plans and specs that were submitted, which were designed for a particular use from the original construction of the building. It's very different than where you have a brand new school, for example, or a brand new building that you're building, and it's constructed to the then current specifications under law.
Right, and they weren't returned to their original condition because they didn't put the asbestos back and things like that when they went through it. So it's not because they upgraded it; they made it safer, you know, to meet some kind of standard. Is that right or not? Or I mean,
they obviously
didn't put the asbestos back. You know, so
I presume not.
And I guess the reason I ask is I'm a little confused on what legally then the DSA is looking at for completion that's different than what is being looked at by the architects.
Well, and I should focus on the distinction between getting DSA certification and filing a notice of completion.
Okay, thank you.
The notice of completion is the item that I talked about you filed that has to do with people filing claims.
Right.
For services performed. The closeout with certification is the process you go through with DSA. And what you're seeking to do, and ideally want to do, is get DSA to close the project with certification, which means DSA says it's built to those plans and specs. We have all the tests, we have all the reports, we have all the data and documentation. We require to say, district, you did that, you performed that project in the way you represented to us and that we approved you would perform it. Where you have certification or closeout without certification, it's where DSA says you've missed something. Either you didn't file some report, you didn't file some other document. It can be major deficiencies, it can be minor deficiencies. But what you're seeking to achieve is close out with certification for DSA purposes.
Okay, now, would you recommend from a legal standpoint that we pay all our vendors before we get DSA certification?
Yeah, because
the way when we do the substantially complete thing is to pay all the vendors and everything within 60 days. So,
yeah, well, you can. It is not unusual for a district to file a notice of completion, mm-hmm. pay off vendors, and deal with those issues, and still not have a project close with certification for years.
And why would we? And then, can you occupy it without a DSA certification?
You can, and districts do. It becomes an issue of one, this concept of design liability and exceptions to design liability, and whether the district and individual board members can be liable.
Of course, we can be liable.
Right,
we're all theoretically liable.
Well, but I'm trying to explain to you why this concept is important, at least theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's not closed with certification, then you lose the design immunity. You don't get the design immunity in the first place. All right, so you're not absolved of liability either as a district or as a board member if an injury results as a result of some inadequacy in the design of the premises.
And that's before we get their certificate, though, from DSA. If we get it from DSA, then we're not liable. Is that correct?
Then you have presumptive design immunity. There can be exceptions for changed circumstances, yes.
So it's during that window is where that issue is, right?
The window.
The window between completion, if the district used it, and then the DSA certificate. That's where the issue of the liability comes, right?
If you occupy the building before you have DSA closeout with certification, then you don't have presumptive design immunity.
Okay.
Even if you occupy the building with design immunity, there are certain exceptions that you can still be found liable. For example, if there's changed circumstances with respect to the property or use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you know a case where board members were held personally liable?
I think you asked me that the last time.
That was about the Field Act.
That was Field Act. Well, it's related to the Field Act.
Yeah.
But my answer remains the same, no.
Okay. Okay. And then what is the liability after, or I guess what is the statute of limitations for us to file claims against architects or contractors, for example, if we didn't get the certificate?
I don't recall the precise statute of limitations. I know, for example, with an architect, by statute, before you can file a complaint against an architect, I believe you have to hire a third-party architect to make a finding and declaration that they believe the architect engaged in some sort of negligence before you could file that complaint. But I don't offhand recall the statute of limitations.
Okay. My other comments and stuff aren't for Mr. Sims, so, I don't.
Yeah, I'd like to direct this.
Hmm?
Anything else to Mr. Sims?
I don't think I have anything else for Mr. Sims.
All right.
I'd like to try to look at each one of the items as you brought forward to the best that I could take notes and do this. So bear with me for just a moment. First of all, you start off by talking about the duration of this particular contract for use through June 11th and perhaps even June 30th. I'm not quite sure what that is. Subject to the revised petition that's going to come forward to us at any point in time. And I understand this is going to take time, but I want you to understand as you're going through this process of where I'm coming from in this negotiations is that the reason that I want this done and want this done now is so that the kids have an opportunity to use it now. That's just simply so. So my frame of mind, absolutely as soon as possible, certainly within every legal aspect taken into consideration, but you know, it's just empty space right now until we put children in it, and that's where my focus is. On user fees, you suggested that we're not required to take fees for the facilities, and when we originally negotiated the contract, it was my intent not to charge them for the fees. But in lieu of us not charging them rent, we then charged them a supervisorial oversight fee. Is that correct? Let me input in that.
Yeah, I believe you are charging an oversight
fee. And that oversight fee by law is what? That rate?
It can be 1% or 3%. I think you're doing
right.
3.
And so we're doing 3, but is there not some language in there that says something to the effect it's 3% not to exceed actual costs?
I don't recall.
I'm talking about in the statutes, not in our contract, in the statutes.
I think that may be correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I understand. I'm not holding
it
to that.
It's our charter school expert, so... I will
trust
defer.
Me. I get too many, free tax advice questions on a daily basis, so I understand that aspect. But oh, never mind. I won't go down that road. But in lieu of that discussion and over the period of time, sort of get this contract done, Edison said, "No, you know what? We're going to pay you the 3% regardless of your cost. They're going to pay us the full 3% of the supervisorial oversight charges that were." You know, required at that time. At that time, I mean the four items of what connotate supervisorial oversight was rather minimal, and the cost probably low. So they're giving us substantially more than likely what they would have had to have done. So, from my point of view, again, helping you with some guidance in the questions that you asked with respect to the $2 per square foot per year. I'm certainly willing to waive those fees. You talked about getting it ready for occupancy. I do have some questions with respect to what our direction was to the plan supervisors, Mr. Larkin, to the architects, all involved as to what we were going to do once this project started after the fire. What were we going to build it up to? I won't get into that just right now. You've mentioned that this program needed to be, that if it was unique to their needs, that they would take the costs. But our costs should be anything up to getting it ready for basically what its original intended use was. Now, certainly we aren't, when it comes to the shop building, we aren't going to make it ready for new shop classes. I mean, that's just ludicrous. It'll never be used for that capacity. But I think that bringing it up to just what we would expect before any of the other district schools would be before we put up a modular building, that whenever that's brought up to that level, then fine. If they choose to use it for something else other than what it was brought up to, that's a cost they're going to have to accept. And I hope that they're up to that also. Let's see.
Mr. Cox, do you mean like exit signs and stuff like that?
Yes, absolutely. Those are just things that just normal up to normal expected use. If they're going to want to build shelves in the building to hold their books, that's their cost. That's not ours. We don't have an expectation to do that. If it requires us to bring it up to district for a DSA approval, that's a district cost. Beyond that is their cost. You inquired about the timing of occupancy for the appropriate intended use and for San Jose Edison in whole and part. And you talked about this concept of the original contract covering a certain amount of time. And I'm just giving you my personal opinion. The others have given you theirs. But in my personal opinion, had these buildings been available at that time, my request at that time would have been, because it was a K-8 formulation, that it would have been used for the entire facility. So you see where that, do you understand what I'm trying to get at, is that this is not something that, we're not separating out two separate facilities and facility locations here. We're talking about one entire school for their use. Because those two were not brought into the discussion at the time we just revised their contract, in my opinion, that's not relevant, that it should be. We should have, had that been available, we would have been negotiating for the entire facility. As far as Building F is concerned, it sounds to me that as long as that is immediately available, I'm certainly, if you have to draft a contract in such a manner that would bifurcate that those issues, making Building F immediately available, then do so. With respect to your additional costs for custodial and nutrition, that's tough, or tougher, because right now they are paying us a flat fee for, I believe it's $217, above $200 per student for the services that they use, that we provide to them. And I don't know how much profit we make on that and those uses of that. And I think that this custodial and nutrition should fall within that same amount. And if it does require, if it turns out that we are less than what we have, what it costs us, then we need to increase that up at marginally to cover those particular costs. So I think I covered those items that you had. So did you want to speak to anything so far? Because I'd like to bring up the Edison attorney so that he can offer his responses to our questions. And then from that, then I think we all have others with respect to addressing the issues that are presented in the site assessment that was given to us by the architects.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Sims. Thank you very much for being here.
Good evening, President Cox and members of the board, and Madam Superintendent. Pleasure to be here again tonight. I'm just going to try and go through some of the questions and try and do my best to answer and clarify as best as I can. So in terms of the additional rent issue, that one of the trustees raised, the provisions of the existing contract between the parties, which are contained on page 9, section 6.6 of the agreement, provide that in recognition of the fact that the district provides school facilities to Edison that are substantially rent-free, the district shall retain 3% of the revenue as defined by law of the charter school to defray the district's costs of complying with its supervisorial oversight obligation pursuant to a couple of cited education code provisions. So it seems clear that at the time that the agreement was negotiated, this was a clear trade. And that, in fact, is what the statute calls for. You can only charge more than 1% in the event that the facilities are substantially rent-free. So I don't think that charging rent for additional facilities or the existing facilities is appropriate. In fact, that essentially is covered by the fact that the charter school is paying the additional oversight fee that otherwise could not be collected by the district. In terms of renovations for the facilities, and by the way, I haven't seen the architect's latest report, so I'm at a bit of a disadvantage in that regard. But what I would like to, I guess, say in terms of the concept here is that the agreement between the parties on page 3, section 3.1A, provides that the district shall continue to provide the charter school with facilities. And you've reserved the right to provide facilities at an alternative site. But then it goes on to say At all times, the facility shall be suitable and appropriate for use as a school by the student population to be served at the site, and in compliance with all federal, state, and local fire, safety, and building codes and requirements applicable to public schools, including but not limited to the abatement of environmental hazards and the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So, in my mind, to the extent that the architect's report ties into fire, life safety, building codes, requirements for public schools generally, or the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's clearly a district responsibility under the provisions of the existing contract. There's an exception, obviously, as noted by the board, with construction projects initiated in specifically in connection with implementation of the E2 design, and that's located in Section 3.1C. However, we have not suggested that any of these are necessary to implement the E2 design, and they're not being requested as a means of implementing the E2 design. And so we don't believe that that exception is applicable. Further, you know, we have not requested any changes be made to any of these facilities. So, you know, to the extent that the district's architect and the district feels that changes are necessary, we certainly can appreciate your desire to provide high-quality facilities to all students in the district, including San Jose Edison students. But we have not requested changes be made to the facilities for our instructional purposes. And so, therefore, you know, to the extent that the district wants to use its discretion to do something additional, that's, I just want to make clear that that's not being done at Edison's request. In terms of the cost of services, just a clarification that the janitorial employees are, as I understand it, actually employees paid by Edison. So we're a bit unclear as to why that is an issue in this discussion. And, you know, to the extent that Edison wants to reallocate that janitorial staff to cover the additional space, that would seem to be, as I see it, within Edison's discretion, and I don't see how that would impact the district's costs in any way. Turning specifically to a couple of the questions that were asked by members of the board, the intent would be that these facilities, that students would rotate through the facilities. So going back to your one of your initial first questions, so it would not be that there would be 170 students in the space that would be sort of continuously using the space, but rather students would rotate through. To the extent that they were in a program, there would be, you know, they would be rotating through all the classes and facilities in the school to meet their academic program, the totality of the program. So while appropriate uses would be made of that additional space, I guess what I'm trying to illustrate is that it's not as though Edison is intending to move some block of kids from the existing facilities to occupy for the entire school day, every single day, those additional facilities, at least at this juncture. In terms of, you know, district staff performing the work, obviously, you know, that's not up to our discretion. So we leave that to your good judgment about whether your staff is you know, has capacity to perform that work. In terms of charters being exempt from bidding laws, we believe they are exempt from bidding laws as a general matter. However, I can certainly understand your council's concern relative to specifically facilities work done on a school district facility. And so to that extent, since the district funds would be used, presumably, for these costs, and since it would be a district facility, I can certainly understand your district's caution, district council's caution in that regard, even if the charter school was exempt. So with that in mind, I guess that's how I would address that point. In terms of the additional costs for food services, I wanted to draw the board's attention to a particular provision of the contract on page 5. It's section 3.1I, and it relates specifically to food services, and it states, the district shall be responsible for providing all food service for the charter school. Food service provided to students at the charter school shall be at a standard and level which is equal to that provided to other district schools and their students, and shall include the period of time when the charter school is in session beyond the district's normal school day and school year. So I guess the question here is, you know, one could, I guess, discuss and debate how broadly to interpret that, but I guess how I look at it is that the district at many other sites is doing more than providing just food carts. They're providing full cafeteria services. And we haven't asked the district to open up full cafeteria food service. So I feel as though, honestly, this is already something by providing food carts that's less than, that's not at the same standard as you might do at some of the other campuses. So again, under the contract, it's clear that that's a district expense. Certainly happy to answer any other additional questions you may have.
Mr. Spence?
I guess the only question I have, and maybe this is one that Mr. Sims can address afterwards too, is what impact is the fact that we did give limited use to San Jose Edison for the one building where they stored things that would have stored in fire?
Let him finish his question.
Well, someone gave him a key. I mean, they didn't break in. I didn't file a police report. You know, I mean, we authorized it somehow, somewhere. You know, and the fact that we had allowed San Jose Edison to submit grant bids to different foundations to try to come up with the money to renovate all those buildings, how that affects the issue of being able to use the buildings.
It would seem to me that I don't think it impacts it much. As I've learned, there was some consideration either at the time of the renegotiation of the charter and the management agreement that Edison was looking at doing some sort of special project and trying to fund it itself. And I don't think the district had any objection to that because Edison was seeking to fund it. So if they sought grant money for that, I think that was consistent with what the parties mutually desired. If they're using some sort of storage facility in one of these buildings or some other building, I don't see how that necessarily impacts the district's obligations here. The point I would reiterate following Jerry's comments is, like I suggested at the beginning of my comments tonight and as we've outlined to you before in writing, there is an argument here that you don't have any obligation either under this contract or Proposition 39 to provide these additional facilities at this time.
Yeah, because of
that said,
is that because of the cutoff dates to request the facilities?
Yes, with respect to Prop 39. And under the even under the management agreement, I think the argument can be made that they can make the request, but under the agreement you don't necessarily have an obligation to provide them with these additional facilities. But the board certainly has the right and authority to make the decision to offer them and provide them. And then it becomes a question on what terms. Right. One argument is that those terms have to be consistent with this management agreement. Another argument is you can write your own new terms if we take the position that this particular management agreement doesn't control the district's provision of these facilities right now. And again, all of this is in the context of the fact that this charter is going to be renewed or amended in some way based upon the petition.
That's an assumption, though.
Well, that's an assumption.
Because we have a contract.
Well, yes.
And while they say they don't like the contract, the board has never voted to let them out of the contract.
Right. No one has terminated the contract.
Correct, yeah.
Under the terms. So, but my point was, I think we can take the position, and I'm sure San Jose would disagree, that we have no obligation to provide these facilities at this time, at this juncture. But the board majority, it appears to us, has made the decision that they want to provide them, and now it's an issue on what business terms are they going to be provided. Yeah. And that's the issue in which we were addressing tonight and seeking clarity.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Spence, just want to address one factual point that San Jose Edison did, in fact, file with the district a request for facilities under Proposition 39 last fall prior to the deadline. And to date, we've received no response from the district to that facilities request. However, I don't want to get hung up on what is, deadlines and responses that, should have been due and things like that. I'd like us to focus really on what's good for kids. Does it make sense? If it's good for kids and it makes sense, then I think the parties should reach agreement and do something that makes sense. The Proposition 39 regulations provide that by mutual agreement, a district and a charter school can set aside the minimum requirements contained in the regulations and mutually agree to do something else. And I think that's what this process and dialogue is about.
Any more? Ms. Shoemaker?
I don't have the contract in front of me. I know better than to come to a meeting with Edison on the agenda and not have the contract. But the section that I refer to that you didn't read has to do with additional facilities. And I consider these buildings additional facilities because when we negotiated the contract again, the facilities did not include the two buildings. One, that were not habitable before the fire. Two, obviously had been destroyed. The contemplation of that build, one of the buildings, was possibly the learning lab under E2. And the provision of the contract that deals with the additional facilities says that we'll negotiate and come to terms just like we do with the daycare center that is on Edison. It was to be handled in the same way. So, again, we already knew that in terms of my thoughts and Edison's thoughts, we were at an impasse on what the contract says. One thing I want to say is Edison has their multi-purpose room where students eat. Every campus in West Covina Unified has one multi-purpose room for the entire campus. So while I agree it's not ideal that if we have a multi-purpose room closer to the junior academy and we can use it that way, great. As soon as it's up to standards and a facilities use agreement is in place, fine. But students at Hollencrest Middle School have to go from one side of campus to the other when it rains to get their food, and they have to find places to sit also. And so we're talking about adding a second multi-purpose room. So that makes it different than our other schools. I really, with the short time frame till the end of the school year, I think it's better handled. Those buildings are better handled as part of the contract, possible contract negotiations and discussion on modifying the contract with Edison going independent than to continue to try and iron out an agreement at this point where there's no agreement on who's responsible for what the cost is, what the process is, and what the buildings will be used for.